Now today we must look at least for a minute at Europe as we begin the course. Europe roughly in 1500. What do we see? What was the attitude towards life like? We must today concentrate on seeing something of the atmosphere of Europe towards 1500. Because the atmosphere does determine man's thought and man's action. And as I said last time, the atmosphere was so different from what we have today. It was determined, first of all, by a hierarchical society. What I mean by that is the life which men lived varied greatly according to their social position. And social position in these terms means inherited social position. The princes and the nobility still affected life and politics directly. But there was growing up another class, a class of intellectuals, the world of learning, which was still largely clerical, still largely made up of people in the church, but which was becoming a distinct class, as we shall see, with a distinct kind of way of life. The urban classes existed already and were rising in importance. To this, of course, we shall come back. The urban classes about which you will read in your Strauss book on Nuremberg in the 16th century. But the vast majority of the population consisted, of course, of peasants. That did not mean that in 1500 the towns were not growing. Urbanism was making already fairly rapid strides. It is during the 16th century that Paris will hit something like 200,000 in population, and a lot of European cities like London will pass the 100,000 mark. The great fact of this rise of urbanism brings to the fore another factor of which we should be aware. The rapid rise of European population. For that rather rapid population rise in the 16th century is going to mean something very important. It will mean an economic crisis. It will mean, in fact, inflation. For the population rise will put pressure on the land. There will not be enough land to feed people. Agricultural advances did not make as much progress as the rise in the population. Pressure on the land will mean rising prices, above all in agricultural produce and foodstuffs. And these rising prices will make almost the entire period of this semester a time of inflation, which will lead to a great deal of unrest and a great deal of hardship, especially, of course, on the poorer part of the population. Now, far removed from each other as these classes were, the princes, nobles, the urban classes, the world of learning, and finally the peasants, 90% of the population, these classes still shared an attitude towards life. Christian, to be sure, of course, but also linked by irrationalism and fear. This was still a primitive society. Death was sudden, and man lived surrounded by what has been called a cloud of unknowing, a kind of cloud of unknowing, a cloud of fear. This was heightened towards 1500, because as we come to the year 1500, times were bad. They had never been that bad before. The price revolution, the inflation I just talked about, was starting. But it was also a time of bad harvests, in addition to the pressure of the population on land. It was also a time of bad harvests. The year 1500 saw a total crop failure in all of Germany. The result were peasant uprisings, looting and pillaging, to such a proportion that one year later, by 1501, we for the first time get a paid police force in Europe. The real scourges were not just the rising prices and the failing harvests. To those scourges of a primitive European population came one other which was worse than these: disease and epidemics. First of all, the plague, or what we call the Black Death, the bubonic plague, which subsided only to return once more. To the populations of Europe, the Black Plague was a willful and arbitrary punishment. Between 1499 and 1502, in those 3 years, as the course opens, whole populations were decimated in Europe. But not enough. Death had not one, but two sides. For a new disease came to join the bubonic plague, hitherto unknown, syphilis. A new plague made it necessary for preachers to call for penance and pilgrimages. For syphilis was a still more frightening plague. It struck suddenly. It vanished only to return again. And the termination of that disease was, of course, awful and disfiguring. Now the result of all of that, bad harvests, rising prices, the bubonic plague, and the new syphilis, meant heightened religious sensibilities, a search for answers. A search for answers why? This search for answers was shared by all the classes of the population that I have mentioned. Now, where did they first turn for their answers? They turned to a literature which was popular in the Middle Ages, that had come down from remote times, which we call books of prophecy. They turned to books of prophecy, which had come down from the Middle Ages and were, no doubt, the most popular books of the age. What was the content of these books of prophecy? Their content is fairly simple. There was hope for the future. After darkness would come light. After Antichrist, I shall come back to Antichrist in a minute. After Antichrist will come the Golden Age. Books of prophecy were prophesying dire times from which good times would spring. What are the roots of the books of prophecy? A part of the Bible, which I'm sure you've never read, but which was, well, you probably never read the Bible. But it is a part, even if you read the Bible, a part of the Bible you very rarely read, but which in that century was undoubtedly the most important part of the Bible. The one that comes last and goes under the books of the Apocalypse. Some of it has gone into our common language, the book with the seven seals, all of that. The Apocalypse is a book written entirely in symbolic terms. And the interpretation, which is vastly important for a lot of things, is this: that before the book of the seven seals can be opened, the wine must be pressed and the harvest reaped. How is that interpreted? Before the second coming of Christ, that is, before light will succeed darkness, there will be bloody wars. The wine will be pressed. And there will be mass conversions of the heathens, but I shall want to come back to that in a minute, especially of the Jews, to Christianity. When that happens, the way is prepared. This means something else, too. It meant that men lived in the expectation that the world was running towards the abyss. It was coming to a close. The book with the seven seals was about to be opened. Luther lived in such expectation, all the Protestant reformers, and many of the intellectuals. But hand in hand with prophecy went astrology. Surely God sends messages to man, and he sends messages through the stars. Astrology went hand in hand with prophecy. The stars are now in an evil conjunction. Saturn is eclipsing Jupiter, Saturn being traditionally the bad planet. It means that Antichrist will come up. It means that for a short while, the Jews will rule the world before their conversion. Blood will run, and then the seven seals, the book with seven seals, will be opened. Now, you know from your English that Shakespeare, at the end of the century, still appealed to the stars. You remember in Shakespeare, he has his Ulysses say that God give harmony to the world through the right movement of the stars. Shakespeare believed in astrology. Now, basic to our age, then, is, if you like, catastrophe, a feeling of lost harmony, a turning to astrology and to prophecies, which will influence the rich and the poor, the learned and the ignorant. Why? There was also the belief in the hierarchical world. The degrees of social status on earth were important, for the idea was that social status on earth corresponded to the heavens, that the whole world was put together by what was called a golden chain, the golden chain of being, that you have a hierarchy of heaven, God and Christ and the archangels and then the lesser angels, and then you go to earth, the kings and the princes, the lords, and down to the serfs. The hierarchy on earth corresponded to the hierarchy in heaven. They were all tied together by one golden chain. This goes back to classical times. It actually comes from Virgil. But it was generally admitted that this belief in the hierarchical world meant a belief in heaven. It meant a belief, if you like, in an ordered universe. How much so you can read, I would like you now to read in Europe in Review, excerpt 19, page 31, which is the so-called Elizabethan homily on obedience. And there you see that the obedience to the Queen is put on this kind of a hierarchical system, that this is the kind of obedience that is required. It can be illustrated many ways, and it is, I think, important to illustrate for you from a book, for example, from 1500. This root of concord, writes an Englishman towards 1500, is good agreement and conformity among the people and the inhabitants of any kingdom, city, town, or fellowship, and every man to be content to do his duty in the office, room, or condition that he is set in, and not to malign or disdain any other. In other words, a hierarchical idea, the great chain. The church had given the sanction to this. This was the Christian universe by divine command. The trouble was, if it had ever really existed, it was now certainly falling apart fairly rapidly. This Englishman, again, who wrote this book in 1500, spends most of his time exhorting people not to rise above their station, not to malign other degrees of population, which meant, of course, that people were just doing that. They were rising above their station. They wanted to rise above their station. They were destroying that kind of universe. There's no question about it. We shall see this, of course, in detail later. But increasing social mobility, a hierarchy undermined by the new urban people, by the new civil servants, by the newly rich, and a hierarchy equally undermined by the alienation of the peasant from society. A hierarchy undermined from both above and from below. This disturbing factor to contemporaries, you must put in side by side with the hunger and catastrophe and all the other things I have mentioned. That golden chain of being, where everything has its place, from God to Christ to the archangels and angels and lords and vassals and serfs on earth, where it has been said by one person that a dog can never become a lion, just as a peasant can become a lord, because nature has her order, nature has her hierarchy. This kind of transference from the hierarchy of nature to the hierarchy of men, this kind of transference was breaking down, and with it a whole ordered universe in which everybody more or less knew its place. The individualism of the Renaissance, to which we shall come next time, of course added to this kind of challenge. Now, small wonder that in such a situation, men looked for safeguards and for explanations. Why? Well, to be sure, the stars are out of joint, as Shakespeare said. There was a dreadful social reactionary, as you know. As Shakespeare said, the stars are out of joint. Another said, well, this is the Antichrist before the end of the world. But where is the evil on earth? Evil on earth must go. Once you have defeated evil on earth, the golden age would come. And the golden age was something both in the past and the future. In a biblical age, they saw the golden age as paradise. Adam and Eve before the fall. Adam and Eve before the fall. Paradise. But the paradise which lies back was to them also the goal for the future. The goal was a society, a paradise, like Adam and Eve before the fall. A restoration, if you like. Now, what is the evil that could be grasped on earth? The evil that you had to get rid of before the book with the seven seals could be opened. Three elements which go with the contemporaries under the heading of Antichrist. All three were unnatural to them, opposed to nature, and therefore opposed to God. The Jews, the witches, and corruption in the church. These were the three matters, the three symbols of the times, the three symbols of evil. The Jews, the witches, and the corruption of the church. The operative word is unnatural, for all offended against the harmony of nature. And because they offended against the harmony of nature, they also destroyed the harmony of political and social life. That must be clear. The Jews, the witches, and the corruption of the church were humanity's burden of guilt, as contemporaries put it. Let us look at each of these for a minute in turn. The years between 1450 and 1510 sees a flood-like increase in the accusation of ritual murder against the Jews. The ritual murder accusation is very ancient. It goes to Roman times, but we must see what is involved. It is the accusation that at Easter time, the Jews kill a young child and drink its blood. What it is, this ritual murder accusation, that Jews slaughter a young child and drink its blood at Easter time, is, of course, connected with the sacrament. This is unnatural. It is a travesty on the Christian sacrament, obviously, which is involved. Turning it around, the blood, the Lord's body, the blood. It is a travesty on the sacrament. The natural order was perverted here. The natural order was perverted. It is such an accusation of ritual murder that led to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. But it went further than this. It led also the fact that the Jews in symbolized humanity's burden of guilt led to something else also. From 1500 on, the Jews were isolated from the rest of the population. Venice began it in 1516 out of commercial rivalry. It confined all the Jews to one district of Venice, a district which until then had a very harmless name. It was called the ghetto. That's where the word ghetto comes from. In 1516, all the Jews of Venice had to move to this district of Venice, which was called the ghetto. And from then on, of course, we call this isolation the ghetto, but it's named after this district of Venice. This spread throughout all Italy and then throughout all of Europe. Eventually, a papal bull put the last seal on it. Jews were to own no real estate, no Christian servants. They were to be indeed, as the papal bull put it, a living examples of the guilt of mankind. And the ghettos, of course, were locked up at night. You can still in Europe, if you ever come to a town which had a ghetto, and most of them did, the iron chains which locked the ghetto up at night. Moreover, it is from this time on that the Jews had to wear special dress, the famous yellow cap and yellow patch, had to wear a special dress, and this again fuses with what I said before. You singled out the Jews. This was humanity's burden of guilt. But on the other hand, because of the book of the Apocalypse and prophecy, Jewish conversion to Christianity must precede the Golden Age. There are lots of biblical passages which can be alleged. And so the 16th century not only singled out the Jews, but is also the beginning of the forced sermons of conversion. Every Sunday, the Jews had to go forcedly to sermons of conversion in churches. This is also the beginning. For as I said, there had to be this double approach. Conversion before the good society could come, and isolation to symbolize humanity's burden of guilt, all starting in the 16th century and going on throughout our period. To the Jews were added the witches, still more frightening, because the witch openly perverted nature. Again, you see the unnatural. The black mass. If ritual murder was taken as a travesty on the Christian sacrament, the black mass was, of course, a travesty on the Christian mass. The incubus, the succubus, the fact that the witch literally married the devil, the fact that the witch had intercourse with animals, the fact that the witch could put spells on you, which indeed perverted nature, made women who should bear children barren. All of this sort of thing, the witch's activity was always a perversion of nature. But this was more frightening. The Jews you could put in a special garb and isolate it. But who knew who was a witch? Witchcraft was taken to be a large secret society. Their identity unknown. And witchcraft served to explain any unnatural event. Indeed, in the end, it came to explain any unconventional behavior in a primitive society. In other words, you were said to be a witch if you behaved unconventionally in any way in your village or in your town. You were apt to have an accusation of witchcraft brought against you. It was indeed an explanation for unconventional behavior of anyone who stood out from the norm. Witches were usually either very, very pretty or unusually ugly. Now, this didn't mean that some people did not believe they were witches. There's very good reason to think that many people accused of witchcraft actually believed themselves to be witches. And this gives you something more of the atmosphere. About that, I think there can also be a very little doubt. Again, here we have then the perversion of nature, the blame for the lost harmony, the burden of guilt, which must be overcome. To the Jews and witches, we must add, finally, perhaps the most important of all, the corruption of the church. For the church in its corruption was also perverting the natural order of things. There is an old play much performed in Germany from the Middle Ages on. The play's title is The Rise and Fall of Antichrist. Antichrist triumphs over kings and emperors, but especially Antichrist triumphs over the church, the very custodian of the harmony and of the divine. The church was cut off from heaven and man with it. God, so it says in the play, does not love worldly priests. What is the problem here? The problem is very simple. The church was intimately involved with present society. It owned a third of the German lands. It was intimately involved with all of politics. It was, in fact, involved with part of the corruption and decline of the age, as men thought of it. Perhaps best explain it to you by an analogy. As some of you think that the university can't fulfill its functions because it has corporate contracts. So people thought that the church could not fulfill its function because it was involved with what they would call the worst part of the corruption of the age. That is to say, with the it sold its offices, as you will read, like any king. It behaved indeed like any secular power. It was more interested in riches than in souls. And so men were cut off from God. Men were cut off from God. And this brought about the dreadful punishment of the age. Now, these matters are important background upon which the history of much of our period is written. The watchword became renewal, the renewal of the church, the conversion of the Jews, the extermination of the witches, renewal, revival. And everybody was concerned with this. The Italian Renaissance, to which we come next time, wanted to do this renewal through a revival of the classical tradition, through a revival of the classics. Luther and Calvin wanted to do it through uncorrupted Christianity. The peasants wanted to do it by returning to the age of innocence, the age before Adam and Eve had sinned, an age, a golden age without famine or peasant or pestilence. How will that be brought about? First, by wars and Antichrist, as I have told you before. And then some Messiah would arise. And it varies. This is varied. Some talked about a peasant emperor who would arise and smote down Antichrist and bring about the golden age. Others talked about an emperor. Some talked about a pastor angelicus, a new kind of pope. All this goes back to a messianism of the Middle Ages. All that is an adaptation of medieval thought. But it must be clear that this is a longing for vanished harmonies. For from 1500 on, we have an age of transition in a very profound way. From a society hierarchical, cemented by religion and custom, to the ruler-centered nation-state. From an agricultural economy to one based on commerce. It is no accident that the image of the Jew as Antichrist was closely linked with the image of the Jew as usurer. And indeed, those two images were linked together and will be in the whole of the history of the Jews. The Jew is the harbinger of a bad modernity. Of a modernity that has to be rejected. Here, the modernity of a commercial as versus an industrial society. And the Jew as Antichrist. This was always connected. And indeed, the priests who went around in the early 16th century and preached in an age that set a great deal of store on preaching. It wasn't a literate age yet. It's the spoken word that counted, not the written word. In an age that set store on preaching, the image was combined. And the greatest preacher of that age, for example, whose name you don't have to remember, Bernardino da Feltre, was especially concerned with the Jews as the burden of guilt, and he thundered against the Jews using the ritual murder accusation. But at the same time, he founded new loan associations, which still exist, the Banco Santo Spirito in Rome. New loan associations. So as to get rid of what he called Jewish usury, put it under church auspices. But still, obviously in all of this is a great deal of hypocrisy involved. I'm not concerned with this. I'm concerned with what it tells us about the age. The new was coming to the surface, never a very popular thing, above all in a primitive age. The men of the times could not know what we know today. They saw everything, the new economics, the new politics, in moral terms. To many of them, all this was a punishment for moral failing, a punishment for moral failing closely connected with the attack upon the hierarchical universe. Thus you have the heightened religious sensibility, the quest for religious safeguards, the masses, the pilgrimages, all of that sort of thing. Let me just remind you of the atmosphere. Martin Luther, who is closest of all people to popular ideas and popular prejudices, made his vow to enter the church when he was nearly hit by a bolt of lightning. Remember that. That gives you an idea of that kind of atmosphere. Moreover, the atmosphere was, of course, of a singular brutality. There were only two kinds of entertainment. One was preaching. Listen to preachers. People listen for 4, 5, 6 hours. And the other kind of thing was what we would call extremely primitive. For example, one village would buy condemned criminals to put on an execution. And this was the other great entertainment. It was a rude age in that sense. Here's a contemporary description of one of these executions of criminals, which that town had bought at great expense, just as today you buy football teams. So there you bought criminals. Really. There was a morbid curiosity among a certain section of the upper classes, which became a fierce, hungry passion with the lower. It was a ribald, reckless, brutal mob, violently combative and fighting and struggling for the foremost places, fiercely aggressive, distinctly abusive. Spectators often had their limbs broken, their teeth knocked out. Sometimes they were crushed to death. Barriers could not always restrain the crowds and who were often borne down and trampled underneath. The crowd standing awestruck as it watched the convulsions of the strangling culprit. Every contortion of limbs was hailed with a cheer or a groan, according as the sufferer was popular or not. Appalling curses and execrations occasionally rent the air and rendered the last moments of the unfortunate criminal more odious. Hawkers boldly sang the praises of their wares, while a fellow creature was being done to death. Rich and poor, thief and lord, gentle and simply attended to see the hanging and crack jokes at the sufferer's expense. This will last until 1815. It will last until the evangelical revival. It will last until right into the 18th century. And in the French Revolution, the reaction to the guillotine will be much the same. It is therefore a rude and criminal age to which you cannot apply the standards of the refinement of morals and manners, which come only much later in our history, as indeed we will see. This makes for a kind of crudeness, both in the fears, in the crowds of unknowing, in the searching for guilt, which I have just explained, in the searching of guilt. How very much different things become, I will leave to your own judgment. After all, for example, ritual murder accusations against the Jews, the last legal action on this was in 1915, when Thomas Masaryk, the later founder of Czechoslovakia, defended the Jew in question. It was revived, of course, by the Nazis, the ritual murder accusation, and it still exists today. So that, in a way, don't think that these things vanish that quickly. But what does change eventually is, at least among the upper classes, a relatively greater sophistication about things. But the basic tenure of what I have said will go on much beyond the period with which we are concerned. Finally, I must point out that these fears and this kind of life was held by learned and ignorant alike, humanists and peasants. For all the new that is emerging with the Renaissance, this, in a sense, remains. The Italian humanists, for example, rallied to the millenarian visions of Savonarola. Millenarian, a term I should explain because we have to deal with it very often, unfortunately, or fortunately. Oh, fortunately, because there's a great deal of millenarianism around right now. What does it mean, millenarian? Well, it obviously comes from millennium, 1,000 years. And sometimes this paradise, this paradise without the fallen Adam and Eve, the good society of the future, is described in the 1,000-year Reich. Now, I know that you associate the term 1,000-year Reich with the National Socialists. You do it quite wrongly. The 1,000-year Reich is an old term from the book of the Apocalypse. It is another term which goes back to its biblical origins. This will be a Reich that will, Christ will come, the second coming of Christ will issue in a Reich that will last 1,000 years. Remember, when the birth span was about 20, 1,000 years was a much longer time than it might seem to us. So that the millennium was about to come, that the millennium was issued in, that all the bad and evil was just the prelude to the good, that was shared by Italian humanists and by peasants. Moreover, both believed, in a way, that the universe was shrouded in secrets and that you could unlock the universe in astrology, but that God also spoke through all sorts of portents, winds and thunder, and for Luther in a bolt of lightning. Nature was not yet the nature we know very largely, which is the mechanical nature man is supposed to conquer. Nature was part of the hierarchy of heaven and earth. Nature was indeed sentient and alive, and God spoke through you, through nature, through thunder, through lightning, to flood. God was trying to tell you something, or to punish you, as I have told you, to punish you, because nobody doubted that there was a system of reward and punishment, and that that system was operated by God, nobody doubted. And that nature reflected it, nobody doubted as well. So that the universe was shrouded in secrets. This was not only astrology, this is also alchemy, about which I cannot talk a great deal. The idea to find gold out of base metals. Why can you find gold out of base metals? Very simple, because the lower always goes to the higher in the hierarchy. And so the base metal may become gold, if God is so willing. But all of this has another side to it. We are so prejudiced. Esoteric knowledge, this is a long subject, I have no time. Esoteric knowledge gotten from the Egyptians, the ancient Hebrews, esoteric knowledge of this nature, alchemy, astrology. All this seemed to us dreadful superstitions. They seem to us superstitions because they mean a universe shrouded in secret. But in reality, they have another side to it. For those who were astrologers, those who were alchemists, those who went in for the more or less occult sciences of Egypt or of the ancient Hebrews, they believed in the last resort that man's mind could fathom the universe. And here is that you must see always things in a dialectical way, that you must never see them in a straight way. You must always see them in a dialectical way. The thing that we might call superstition is really one of the forces that was to drive Europe ahead. For you could not be an alchemist and you couldn't be a reader of the Kabbalah, which is a mystical Jewish book which became very important and goes back to Egypt and ancient hero mysteries, mysteries of numbers. You could not read the Kabbalah, you couldn't be an alchemist or you couldn't be an astrologer without making a basic presupposition that indeed, if I get enough esoteric learning, I can unlock the secrets of the universe. And this is going to be a prerequisite for the whole thing that we call the rise of sciences. So that there is there a kind of dialectic, that a superstition is not just a simple superstition. It may also, as it were, reverse itself into a dialectical process. I think there is, therefore, no clear division in any of this between traditions which hold back and forge ahead. Let me give you another example of this dialectic. Millenarianism, traditional. You don't look forward to a new society. You look back to the paradise before the fall. You want to recapture your innocence. Back to paradise before the fall. But in reality, this millenarianism will push forward, for it becomes a dynamic revolutionary myth. It becomes a dynamic revolutionary myth. It will push people to revolutionary action. And that revolutionary action, again, will drive things forward. So that in the study of history that way, you can never use a simple approach and say, what a silly superstition. I don't want to go back to paradise or recapture my innocence. About some of you who have certain ideologies, I'm not too sure. but want to recapture my innocence. But even if you wanted to recapture your innocence, what that meant in the content of historical advance is the creation of a vital and dynamic revolutionary myth. Here again is an example of how of these things worked. Indeed, there was a whole sect called the Adamites. And indeed, Luther's right arm, the professor who taught Luther, gave up his chair, bought a farm, and became, as it were, the romantic behind the plow, because the thing was to go back to paradise before the fall, which was, of course, a vision of Arcadia, a rural vision of a rural community. But it still was, at the same time, a dynamic social myth. From all of this follows one thing. As we now come to the change in European thought, from all this, to a different and perhaps newer way of looking at the world, which contemporaries call the Renaissance or the Rebirth, already going on by the year 1500, being indeed in full swing by the year 1500. We must not confuse the modern and the ancient. The humanists, the intellectuals of the Renaissance, were not rationalists in our modern sense of the word. They did not believe just in reason. They were not the ancestors of modern rationalists, and historians in the 19th century always believed they were. For these intellectuals also believed in portents and signs and astrology and in nature, as I have described it. They also believed in this, but they did add something new to the fund of European attitudes. What they added new was their rejection of Christianity. Their rejection of a theological base on which everybody had agreed. Their rejection. And they tried to put it on a different kind of foundation. A foundation which they took from a revival of the classics of Greece and Rome, rather than going on with the interpretations of Christianity, such as which I have given you today. I would suggest to you very strongly, whether you are prospective revolutionaries or whether you are a prospective bourgeois. It really doesn't matter. That sometime in the next weeks you get hold of a Bible. This is difficult, I know, but some of you may actually succeed. And look at the book of the Apocalypse, because that is what these people looked at. The kind of symbolism, the wine press, the book with the seven seals, the dragons, all of that thing that goes throughout the book of the Apocalypse and on which these interpretations are based. For the line between ideas and action is very thin. I have just tried to explain to you today this very kind of thing. There is a theory, the book of the Apocalypse, the books of prophecy are much read. This is what people believe, and then they go to action, putting the Jews in ghettos, the sermons of conversion, the burning of witches. All this was to go from certain basic presuppositions which they got from the Christianity of their time as they read it, the prophecies above all, and the Acropolis, to action. It does go to action. It is not divorced from it. That must be clear from what I have said. Now, in the Renaissance, which starts in about 1450, intellectuals began to question some of this. But as I have said, not all of this. And to go over from it, indeed, to a new kind of attitude. But there are no new kinds of attitude. Nothing springs like Venus from a shell, you know. They shared the superstitions, the prophecy, the revolutionary dynamic of millenarianism. The most important, that continues. All other revolutionary doctrines will fall by the wayside and are no longer applicable. This has a very great, this millenarianism, revolutionary building, a very great part in the building of what one might call revolutionary mythology, especially in underdeveloped regions, of course. But these people wanted to, in a way, discontinue the Christian theological base, wanted to use the classics in their quest toward certainty. And the center of that was Italy, for Italy had always had a modern, rather than medieval aspect. And the center of it was in Italian towns, for Italy had always had a more urban than rural civilization. And it is typical that the first new push, the change of thought, if you like, comes from an urban, not a rural environment. The new comes from the urban, typically enough, but not from a rural environment. And with the Italian Renaissance, then, we shall continue next time. Now, hand in your card in the back. I wish Mr. Goldberg's class...